We're going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order.
Oh, it's a bike ride.
Welcome to the State Government Finance Committee. Glad to see all of your faces here. We have some, quite a few new members to the committee. Out of our 17 membership, we have 12 new members. So we're going to be spending some time and doing some reviews and getting to know all the agencies that are under our purview. But for today's purposes, we do have a bill that we're going to address here on the front end of things. But before we do that, I just want to draw your attention. In your packet are the committee rules. You also receive this via email. It has the structure for amendments and so forth and any other kind of material. So if you could please review that and be familiar with it as we participate in the committee process, it'll just help things go more smoothly. So we will be doing introductions later on, but I think just for initial purposes, because we're going to probably utilize some staff here, if the pages could come to the front table and just introduce yourselves.
Hi, my name is Annika Jansen. I'm the page on this committee.
Is it Annika James?
Annika Jansen.
Jansen, okay. Annika, welcome to the committee. And then who else do we have? Is that it for now? We'll catch them later. And then if staff around the table here, too, could introduce themselves. Sam, you can start.
Sam Moyer, committee legislative assistant.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Brian Cook. I'm the Republican Caucus researcher for this committee.
And Madam Chair, members, I'm Helen Roberts. I'm from the House Fiscal Staff.
And Madam Chair, Matt Gehring from Nonpartisan House Research.
Madam Chair and members, John Holmquist, committee administrator.
And then we also, Mr. Geldman.
Madam Chair and members, Jim Geldman, DFL Caucus Research.
Thank you. So if you have questions during the first bill that we have up, feel free to reach out to staff as well. With that, Representative Hoffe, would you come to the table, please? And I'm going to move House File 107 to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And welcome to the committee. And if you can state your name for the record and your bill, and go ahead with it.
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Joe Hoppe. I'm the state representative from Chaska and the author of House File 1. And House File 1 is dealing with health insurance and trying to strike a balance between reforms and getting people some premium relief. The premium relief would be in 2017. The reforms, a couple of them might touch on 2017, but most of the reforms we're looking at are for the future. We are concerned about the increase in rates for this year, but we're more concerned about the future of the individual health insurance market in the state of Minnesota, I mean nationally, but you know, we're focused on the state of Minnesota. Everything we do in this bill and everything we talk about, and this is a work in progress. This bill is being worked on in the Senate. I think this is the third of four committee hearings today in the House dealing with all or parts of this bill. Our goal is to get this passed and get it to a conference committee and work out a bill that the House can maybe not like but agree to go along with, the Senate the same, and a bill that the governor will sign. And with that, Madam Chair, I've probably taken up enough time with an introduction. I think everybody knows this by now. So however you want to proceed, if you want testifiers or amendments or questions, your discretion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. Members, I'm going to draw your attention. In your packet on this bill, there is a preliminary fiscal note. And the reason that I want to draw your attention to that is I do have an amendment that would reflect the change in the amount for that. And if I could have a page come forward here, we'll distribute that amendment just to get the bill in the proper order.
Madam Chair, do you want me to speak to that amendment while
it's being distributed? If you would, while it's being distributed.
This is the Chair's amendment, but I think it's a friendly amendment and makes the bill a little bit better. We had an appropriation in House File 1 of $500,000 to go to the OLA, the Office of Legislative Auditor, to be checking in on this program, and the auditor has come back and informed fiscal staff that they can do it for $157,000. We're happy to round it down to that number.
Great. Members, any questions to the amendment? We'll wait a moment so you get a chance to take a look at it.
Thank you.
Okay, members, with that, I'm going to move the A2 amendment. Any questions to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The A2 amendment has been adopted. Okay, members, I think at this time we'll ask to see if there's any questions to Representative Hoppe before we go to testifiers at all. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to make note of the fact that given this is a finance committee that we should have a fiscal note, I think there's one that reflects the legislative auditor's work, but be that as it may, given the amount of work that's expected from state government in this particular draft, seems like a fiscal note would be in order. So no response is needed, really, other than just making note of that. But I do have a question for the author.
Sure, Representative Johnson. And you did see the fiscal note on the legislative audit.
I did. Thank you very much.
Very good. Representative Johnson, your question.
Representative Hoppe, how do you foresee this program as it's currently drafted being advertised? I mean, how would people find out about it?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson. I guess I hadn't given that a lot of thought, but like a lot of other things, this bill, as I have mentioned once or twice before, is a work in progress. We'd be happy to talk about that, but I think there will be a lot of publicity about this. And if I were somebody who were paying a huge amount of money for health insurance premiums, and I think word is going to get out, and I think people will rather quickly jump to this if they get a chance to save, you know, 25% of their monthly premium.
Representative Johnson, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As far as if you don't have broadband access, that sort of thing, you just think just kind of mailings and that sort of, what do you see happening?
Well, Representative Hoppe can maybe help out a little bit on this too. I was just reading here, you got on page 3, Representative Johnson, on line 29 through 31. Here it says that the health plan company shall make the application forms developed by the commissioner available on their website and shall include the application forms with premium notices. So each individual, whether they have broadband access or not, will be able to have the information available to them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I don't know if Representative Hoppe wants to comment to that at all. Or
that was perfect, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hoppe, do you have any idea on how the appeal process would work with the transitional coverage if someone was rejected? How would that actually play out?
Representative Hoppe.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, and members, I think that that's one of those things we can still work out. I mean, as I keep saying, you know, there is work to be done here. And this, we're hoping that we can get to a bill that, I mean, this does us no good to do all this work if we come up with a bill that the governor won't sign. So I'm hoping we can get to a bill that all of us wind up voting for, and we can get the technicalities figured out. And I don't have a great answer for you right now, but I'll come up with one.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I have a variety of other questions, but as you know, Representative Hoppe, it's a work in progress, so we won't keep the point going for that same answer over and over. But I would like to hear at some point from Mayor in France, Commissioner France, on the bill, which you probably have in mind anyway. So.
Yep,
thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Hoppe. Are you going to do some, Paul Bunyan ads, maybe, or? Sorry, that's...
Representative Hoppe.
Representative Hoppe, I was wondering on a serious note. I'm just concerned about how the data privacy stuff is going to all work out. I'm not one of those people, but I work for a major employer that cares about the vote, you know, the ID issue, and we've kind of ran into roadblocks there. And I'm just worried here where we're going to have private vendors, you know, somehow involved with people's data and information, and so it just concerns me that we're just how that's all going to flow and work. And I just have to be honest, it does have a little bit of tinfoil hat concerns to it. Just wonder if you have any ideas or thoughts on that.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lilly. We did have, I mean, that thought occurred to me too, and Representative Lesh brought this up on the floor, whatever it was, last week, Thursday. And so the bill, or at least part of the bill, went to civil law this morning. I wasn't there. I'm not on civil law this year, but it passed, that part of it passed out of the bill, so, or out of the committee. So I assume that they had a full and thorough hearing. I haven't seen what they did yet, but I understand your concerns, and we're willing to address it more, and I can talk to you more about it offline after we find out how it went in civil law.
Thank you, Chair Hoppe.
Okay. With that, Representative Uglum?
Yes.
Uglum? I always struggle with that all the time.
Thank you, Madam.
I will tell you, I will struggle with all of your names at some point, and I apologize in advance. I have Anderson. That's pretty simple. So.
Yeah, that's really Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hoppe, I understand in this bill there are some provisions for reform of the health care. Could you elaborate on some of that?
Representative Hoppe.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Uglum, there are, and if you turn to, I'm going to look and see what page of the bill we're on here. I can run through, are there any specific reforms you were looking at? Probably the thing that's going to get the most attention for people. In this bill, we have something for a provision in there to change what's been a longstanding Minnesota policy and to allow for-profit insurers to come into the market. The reason we are thinking that is if we are now down in, I think it's 62 of our counties, we're down to one insurance choice for health insurance for people. If we don't fix this, what happens next year? What if, you know, Blue Cross decides they're losing too much money and they can't operate, and we have 62 counties or 50 counties or any number of counties where there isn't a choice? And I understand that nationally some of the for-profit insurers have been getting out of the single individual health care market. Whatever we do here, something different is going to happen next year because of what's coming from the federal government. We don't know what that's going to be yet, but one way or the other, the individual health insurance market will be different next year. And I think hopefully the changes will be enough to get people, you know, more interested in our individual market here, the current insurers. But if, I mean, we need to do something if we're looking at even the potential of having no insurance options in large parts of our state. We have to do something. So that'd be kind of one of the marquee things. There's some other what people would term smaller. I think everybody, and I don't want to speak for the governor, but I think everybody understands we need some kinds of reform. I think the debate is really how much goes in this bill, how much goes in, you know, further bills this session, and exactly what the reforms will be.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. The issues that Chair Hoppe are talking about, I don't think are in this bill, although I appreciate the discussion of it, but I don't think they're in the bill that's before us, for what it's worth.
Representative Lilly.
Having read the bill.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I'm sorry, I had one more question. Chair Hoppe, I was just curious what, on your bill with House File 107, what would be the fastest that, you know, that someone could get a check in their hands? Because we heard a lot about this through the fall. You know, I'm sure you did as well, and it was a big issue. But so I'm just curious how fast. I mean, because that's, you know, I know. Anyways, I don't want to be partisan, but the governor kind of had a proposal. You know, regardless, it would have been nice to have this up and running, but. Yep. Even if we play this through, given the course that we're going, what's the best case scenario that someone could have a check in their hand and up and running?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lilly. And I don't want to speak for Commissioner Franz. He's going to come up and tell you what the scenario is if we do what the bill is and we send it through the state. With the governor's plan, and we sent checks to the insurance company and let them put on a rebate to the people that are paying the premiums. We're probably looking at, once the bill passes, I guess the best guess from them is that we're looking at 3 to 4 months before they get up the system and things get up and running.
Representative Lilly, any follow-up?
Chair Anderson and Chair Hoppe, thank you. I just, I thought I had heard that it might be pushing a year even, and then I would be disappointed if that were the case. I'm a little bit shocked as well that it would take so long, but I think that would kind of defeat the purpose, but I'm sure you would agree with that, Chair Hoppe.
Representative Hoppe, your goal is 3 to 4 months, correct?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, and I'm not sure if we're on camera, but let the record reflect that I was nodding while you were speaking, Representative.
Excellent. All right. Seeing no other questions at this point, Commissioner Franz is here. You wanted to offer some input.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Commissioner Franz, please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, Myron Franz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for letting me table here with Representative Hoppe. I appreciate the opportunity.
And Commissioner Franz, can you talk into the microphone a little bit? It's,
yes, I can.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
I will do the thank you, Madam Chair. I think I want to start off by saying that there are many things that we agree with today with respect to premium relief and reform for the individual market. But the critical thing is the timing and the process in which we go through in completing these different tasks. The governor's goal, and when he was developing his health insurance subsidy last October, was to provide immediate premium relief to Minnesotans. And some of those are already paying their first premium insurance now. If we had implemented this in October, November, they would already be getting relief. But there are thousands of more out there, we believe, who have not yet decided whether to purchase insurance on the individual health market yet. They have until January 31st when open enrollment closes. So one of the real concerns that we've had from the very beginning is to provide relief so that those people know what relief is available and when will it show up. And I think that's the problem we have right now, is that every day that goes by, we have people who don't know when there's going to be relief, if there's going to be relief, and how much that relief will be. So we believe step one, and I can confirm what you said for the governor, he really does believe in both premium relief and reform for 2018. He said that a lot, and so it's appropriate for you to mention that. But we want to focus in the next few days on premium relief. One of the things that the governor proposed in terms of stabilizing the market was to have as much time as possible before January 31st so that we can help improve that market by having more and more people sign up and be part of that market. But if we take some of these, frankly, unvetted proposals and pass them now without taking the time to go through them, then the governor's concerned about that part of the reform. If there's reform that needs to come for 2018, he is willing to listen to virtually any idea and any reform proposal, but he doesn't believe it should be in this first bill. So I just want to take just 1 minute to describe the governor's proposal and then contrast that with what I think is going to be required by House File 1. You know, one of the things that we did initially when looking at this plan was to figure out how can we get relief to insureds as quickly as possible. We also toyed with the idea, or thought about the idea, of limiting it based on income. So we went to the plans, we went to our folks, and we started figuring out how to do that. And we realized we couldn't do that in a way that would really be able to be implemented soon in 2017. It's just too cumbersome. The plans don't have that kind of information about people, so we'd have to figure out how to marry up the plan information with federal taxable income. So we believe, the governor believes, that it's more important to get relief, certain relief, as soon as possible than trying to have an income-tested procedure. So that's why we then went to the plans and said, well, let's take a look at your invoice system. So as we know, everybody in the individual market who signs up has insurance with a plan. Every month they get a premium notice and they pay that. So let's say, for example, I got a premium notice in March for $1,000 under the governor's plan. The notice, the invoice, would say a 25% reduction, and I would just pay $750, and I would save $250 on that invoice for the insurance. And then after that fact, every month, the plans would send to us the list of people who bought insurance and how much money we owed them out of the $312 million for that insurance. So our goal was to reimburse the plans for the premium relief that they provided on the invoice. And it's really that simple. The idea was to make sure that we had an opportunity to audit this, and so we put money in the bill that would provide $300,000 to the Department of Commerce to do an audit after the fact, or as this was going on, to verify that these are in fact the right folks. But remember, one of the things that's the difference between the governor's proposal and House File 1 is the fact that we're not sending checks out to individuals. So under House File 1, we're going to send thousands of checks to thousands of people every month, and that's where fraud opportunities arise. And so we would have to, and I'll go through the process of how we would vet that, but under the governor's proposals, the only thing that's going to happen bad is that someone's going to get cheaper insurance for and that's all they're going to get. Now, maybe they got the federal tax credit and they're double dipping. We'll have to watch that and monitor that. But the worst thing that's going to happen is someone's going to buy insurance for less than they would have normally had to pay. Now, the bill, House File 1, provides, I think it's $8.5 million for administrative costs. And our analysis is that is nowhere near the amount that we're going to need. So let me just kind of walk through how I went through this. I'm not here with answers yet. We're still working on the fiscal note, to Representative Johnson's question. It's a difficult note to write, and we're analyzing the data now. We're obviously checking information in the private sector within government to make sure we get this right. But we just started looking around state government. Where have we built systems that have this functionality? Well, at the Minnesota Department of Revenue, we built a number of years ago the integrated tax system, which cost $40 million, took 5 years to do. Well, obviously, that's more than what we need to do here. But that was a very complicated effort, and it had some of the same functions that we have to do. The statewide integrated financial tools cost $65 million over 2 years to implement. That's the state's accounting system, which provides financial procurement and reporting services. And finally, we all know that the MnSure system cost over $200 million in IT development costs alone. So what we tried to do was analyze what portions of those IT systems are available or that we can use or that we can somehow figure out to configure to implement this process. Part of the difficulty, though, is that I want to describe sort of the process of connecting with the insureds. So as Chair Anderson mentioned, there's a web application process. So the first thing we need to do is set up a web application process. And that's going to be where the people who have paid their premium will then send an application into us, and they will have to have their social security number, date of birth, you know, sensitive and private protected data in that information. So then once we get that, then we're going to have to then go back out to the health plans and cross-check that and verify, did in fact these 20,000 people pay health insurance to you, and make sure we confirm that data. Then we're going to have to take that data and go to the Department of Revenue or deed and then verify residency to make sure that these folks are Minnesota residents. Once again, we're taking sensitive private data and trying to take one data system to talk to another data system that already exists. So this exchange and sharing of data is not a simple thing. Then the next step, which is really important, and that's the income verification step. Now, to do this, we're going to need to be able to interface with federal tax data, because that's where the modified adjusted gross income is, that information is available. So what we would have to figure out is a way to tap into that system. Now, right now, I shouldn't say tap into that system. Sounds like I want to hack it. It's not true. What we want to do is figure out a way to interface, because that's what MnSure does now. They have a way to test people's income and verify the income. We would have to set up a separate system or component that would do the same thing. But remember, the MnSure system was set up under the Affordable Care Act rules and regulations. This data system and this group of people would be different. Some of them would be in MnSure, but most of them would not be. So we'd have to set up another new system to make sure that we could identify that. And we'd have to ask the IRS for approval to use their system. The other problem that we have is that the difficulty or the complexity is sort of what we call the rule engine. This is where the rebate levels change based on modified adjusted gross income throughout the year. So we need to design a program that will take the monthly information that we get from the insurance carriers for each applicant and apply those rules. So remember, in the governor's rules, everyone gets a 25% premium rebate. Under these rules, there are five different categories in the statute. We'd have to determine, do they qualify under the income test, under the residency test, and then also, well, let me just give you an example. If you took a family of two with a 2016 income of $97,000, they would qualify for a 25% rebate for the first 3 months of 2017, but starting in April, they would receive a 20% benefit. So right now, just think about those folks in January, trying to decide by January 31st what they want to buy. They have to kind of apply that test and see which category they fall into. On the other hand, there's a family of four with 2016 income of $97,000. They would qualify for a 25% rebate for the first 3 months, and then a rebate of 30% starting in April. So we have these different income brackets that we have to figure out and make sure people know. To your points earlier, representatives, about we'd have to communicate this in a way that people could understand that. And listen, I'm a tax lawyer, and I think this stuff is getting complicated. So then we would have to go into the fraud prevention. as I mentioned earlier, the fraud reduction goes down quite a bit in the invoice system because there's a transaction going on there between the insured and the insurance plan. And in the House File 1, we're sending checks out to thousands of people. So, and we have a lot of sensitive data. So we've got to make sure if we're going to give a refundable tax credit, we only want to pay it out, like a refundable tax credit, we only want to pay it out to those people who qualify. And the other thing that we're a little bit concerned about, too, is the sensitivity of the data, because we'd have to have a lot of interfaces. We'd have to make sure that these people were enrolled in our financial accounting system, because they're not in our system right now anywhere. So we would have to give them a vendor number, and then they would become a vendor to the state of Minnesota, and that's how we would make the payments to these folks. We'd also have to have a reporting system for 1095 tax forms and maybe other forms we're not aware of yet. Now, for the audit preparation, whether it's the Office of Legislative Auditor or the Department of Revenue, we would have to make sure that as we're building these systems and we do these interfaces and we have these checks and balances, someone's got to be able to find that, you know, 6 months later or 9 months later. So the audit trail's got to be there. So we need to make sure we build in ways that someone can look at this after the fact or months after the fact. We estimate that just to take the applications for 100,000 people, let's say, probably 2 hours from beginning to end. So when you send in your application, when it gets reviewed, when it comes back from income verification or residency verification, or maybe you changed your situation, we would have to have about 2 hours per application. That's 200,000 hours. That's 100 people. And that's just doing the applications.
Well, Commissioner, I'm just a little concerned about the assumption that it would take 2 hours to process the applications. I mean, state government has provided the function of providing checks to individuals across the state many times over. We do the renter's checks every single year. We had a very famous governor, Governor Jesse Ventura, did the Jesse checks, you know, for a cost of $1 million only to the state. I mean, there's a litany of examples of where we have done this, and we've done it well in state government for, in my lifetime, many times over. I appreciate the comments. I'm interested in seeing the final fiscal note. I know yesterday you were in the news and you talked about a cost of, you know, $20 million, which I'm a little concerned about given the fact that we don't have the final fiscal note, and that seems well above what I would ever imagine given our past history in other areas as well. Also concerned that I'd had just a meeting with you an hour prior to that asking about how we could address some of the concerns that you have, and you know that was never mentioned during that time either. I think Chair Hoppe has expressed many times over his willingness to work on this issue, and I think we'll have some opportunities to make some changes to address some of the concerns that you've had here. But
well, Madam Chair, I
apologize for interrupting.
Well, no, that's fine, but with respect to all the examples you mentioned, all those people were already in the system. All the Jesse checks went to people who were in the tax system. The income taxes are paid for because they're in a system and we know who they are. The difficulty in developing a new database with a new group of people, 100,000 or 150,000, is we don't know who these people are and they're not part of our system. So to suggest that we can just easily do that based on the checks, we can send out the checks, but there's so much we have to do before we get to the check process that makes it difficult. In fact, part of the thing that I tried to talk about the other day with you is that we don't do this sort of thing routinely in state government. In fact, I would suggest that we should have a request for a proposal. We need to find out how does the private sector do this. There are people out there who are doing these kinds of components that interact with other kinds of components. If we did an RFP process, that's a six-month process right there just to bring on board a private vendor to do this kind of a thing. I mean, one of the difficulties is that we don't want to propose to this committee or to the legislature a system that doesn't work, that doesn't get done on time, and that we all of a sudden we have people in 6 months or 9 months complaining about another government system that's not running very well. So clearly we don't want to have that happen, and we're willing to work with Chair Hoppe and with you and anybody else to come up with other suggestions. But the idea of taking and changing the system so that we have to write checks, That in and of itself creates an unbelievably difficult burden and complexity that I don't think we need to do. And that's why the governor's proposing that we utilize the invoice system that's already in existence. We want to save money. We want to get the money to the insureds.
Commissioner, I appreciate those comments. You know, obviously we have access to a lot of different data on individuals across the state. You can slice it and dice it and get access to that information in multiple different ways. My question for you, though, is dealing with the governor's plan in particular. How do you verify residency through the governor's plan? Since I've got you here and you said that you have a limited amount of time, I do have this question that just, if you can help me out, how is the governor's plan, how do they verify residency here?
Well, that you know, for the first part of that process, so when the insured makes that invoice payment to the insurance company, that'll be the first check. So first of all, is it made by someone who's residing in Minnesota? And that's why we wanted money for Commerce to make sure that after the fact that all the premium payments were paid to people that, you know, bought insurance and that were residents. So we're still working. That's why the fiscal note's not done. We're still working on how we would implement a residence check, not only on House File 1, but also on the governor's plan as well. But actually, the information, I think this situation is worse than I originally thought after this morning. It's come to our attention that, you know, under the governor's plan, because it's a direct payment of payments to the insurance plans, it qualifies under, I mean, the IRS has to determine whether something is taxed, whether it's taxable or not. But based on IRS rulings and other IRS guidance, we believe that the relief payments to the insurers for the purpose of reducing these premium payments to individuals would likely not be taxable under federal law. However, once again, the IRS would have to ultimately determine that. We believe that payments to individuals, direct payments to individuals, might just be taxable to the federal government. So that adds a whole other level of complexity. But the whole point is, by insisting that we write checks to thousands of individuals every month, we're creating a complexity and a system that we don't need to do. And I guess I don't understand why we have to go down this road when we have an alternative that works so much better. I'm at a loss.
Well, Commissioner, I guess I'm a little still very nervous about the verification process and the auditing process on the governor's plan and how we verify that. I mean, we basically are relying on these private vendors being the providers to do the work of government to verify residency, to make sure that the checks are going to the individuals, or I should say, it's noted on their premium notices, and we as a government are just going to maybe pick 10 out of the however many thousands of individuals to do a check on. And so if you can just talk to me a little bit more about that piece of how we're going to verify that the governor's rebate is going to work, because I'm having heartburn with that piece in particular.
Madam Chair,
and that fraud is not committed, because I can see that as a huge potential for fraud.
Well, Madam Chair, no, I appreciate your concern. I think there's two areas we're concerned about, and one is to make sure the people who got the federal tax credit, mm-hmm. under the mentor, that they don't also get the rebate, because you're only under the governor's plan. I think under House File 1 too, you can only get the rebate if you don't get the federal tax credit. So that's one check we have to do to make sure. We'd have to take those lists of the insureds and check them against some insurer records. And that's something we think we can do with Commerce. And then the other thing is the residency verification, and we're still working on how often, how many files we'd have to examine on a regular basis to determine whether we think that that's a minor or a major issue. We don't know that yet.
And okay. Commissioner, the other question that I had too is, what part of the governor's plan addresses the continuity of care?
Madam Chair, the governor does not have a continuity of care in his provision, and certainly one of the things that he has said repeatedly the last several days, if there's a continuity of care provision for 2017 that the plans that can work with and the legislature thinks is important, he believes that that is something that might be acceptable. He's never said that he would not go along with the continuity of care provision if it's written in a way that is acceptable to people who need to implement it.
But as it stands now, there's nothing in his plan that addresses those people's concerns.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. I've got Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. And through your enlightenment on the governor's plan and the general background, some things have come up. First, about the communication the other members mentioned, I don't know anyone, unless they're living in a rock, that hasn't heard the media and everybody else covering this topic. And so I think we got a lot of free publicity besides what the chair enlightened about the actual mechanisms for the details. But if my understanding is correct, the state received from the federal government, I think over $1 million to help implement this, the PPACA. We spent hundreds of millions of dollars to generate the back end, and you're saying that we need to have all these verifications and checks, which should already be consistently part of the process we've been paying for, have paid for, and needed in order to follow the federal law, such as a residence check. We already should have the mechanisms to access the income and health data. That was actually part of the federal legislation that allowed for access between many of these silos of data bases, so that one could go out and do this eligibility and verification and be able to easily audit it. So those are things that were paid for years ago that should be existent, and you could take those applications and that code and just add a few more lines of database queries with logic statements to be able to do the same thing for the additional income thing. So are you telling me in the committee that all this stuff that should already be existent, should already be, have been implemented, don't work, are not functional, and that's why it will cost us all this time, energy, and dollars to implement something that should already be there?
Commissioner Frantz.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, let me be clear that those systems are in place for certain people. For example, if I'm understanding your concerns correctly, you know, MNsure does have those systems available, and that's what people do. They go through MNsure, their income gets verified, they determine whether they qualify for the federal credit. But the largest share of the people in the individual market that are not qualified under the MNsure to get the federal tax credit are not currently in that database. So we don't have a system that deals solely with people in the individual market that have not qualified for the MNsure tax credit. So those systems do exist, and they work in some ways, but not for this new group of people we're talking about.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, the actual software and database queries access databases that include manyfold more people that aren't getting subsidies in order to calculate and verify eligibility, because people's statuses change year to year and even sometimes in the middle of the year. And therefore, you've got the database that you have access with a huge set. The system goes in and does a query, sorts and grabs out and creates the data, you know, the smaller subset that you're working with. So the mechanism that does that for this income group is the same mechanism, and the database that it's accessing is the same global database. So, you know, frankly, saying that it doesn't work, you add a few lines of query code with logic in it, with the, you know, bandwidth of income, and you're doing the same thing, and you generate this new database, because it's a subset. And so everything, I mean, in grad school I took computational analysis courses, and in real world outside work I did database queries and set this stuff up. So I, you know, frankly, nothing you've told me gives me any clarity as to why there's not the capability for something we should already be doing with you know, maybe a few hours of additional coding to change parameters and add new lines. So, you know, I guess I still have not been convinced by your statement.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Frantz.
Remember, the database at MNsure was set up under the Affordable Care Act rules. and the income determinations are based upon those rules. The income determinations on House File 1 do not mirror those. They're different. And there's also different people. We simply cannot add people to the MNSHR system and expect that logic, the rule set or the logic set of MNSHR to work with these folks. First of all, MNSHR doesn't have the capacity to add another 100,000 or so people to manage and go through that process. And secondly, it is a different set, and it's not just a few tweaks. And I'm not an IT person, but we can get someone and talk to you offline if that would be helpful.
Great. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Quam, I do think it's important to have clear and concise communication once we get a product done here, because it's been so ever-changing and it is complex. So I think we want to get it out to the folks what the exact end product is so people can apply accordingly. So I think that is essential and important. It needs to be part of whatever program is put together. The big question for me is, Commissioner France, is what is the time frame then that you see, given the complexity of the IT infrastructure needs and the different database systems and all the work that needs to be done, in order for a check actually to get in the hands of an applicant?
Commissioner France.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, based on my discussions with people in the private sector about how much time it takes to make these interfaces work, to have these handoffs work from one data set to another data set, we believe we would need to have a request for a proposal, an RFP, to bring in someone to help us design part, if not most of this, and that in and of itself is a six-month period. We don't believe we can get checks to people until January of 2018, and we think it'll cost at least $20 million. That's my preliminary analysis. We're still working on it. We'll get you the fiscal note as soon as we can.
Representative Nash. Oh, he's gone. Okay. Commissioner, I just want to go back to the sales tax, the tax piece of it, though, or the, I should say, the rebate portion of it, because we have done sales tax rebates in the state prior to this where we haven't had that fall under the IRS, making it taxable at all. So clearly we have a history where the feds have said, no, this is not going to be taxable. This is even less likely to fall under that category. Your former commissioner of Department of Revenue, clearly you know that as well. So, I get a little concerned about that claim that this is potentially could have a tax implication for people when they get this rebate, because clearly precedence has shown that that is not the case.
Well, Madam Chair, with all due respect, I was a tax lawyer for 30 years, ran the Department of Revenue for four, and the subsidy that we looked at to determine whether the IRS would tax the governor's proposal was that as long as it was part of a relief payment that went to the insurance carriers as part of a cost reduction in health premiums, that would likely not be taxable under federal law. Once again, it's the IRS to make that determination. But when you take away that direct payment to the insured and instead give a direct payment to the individuals, then that creates a different concern on our part. The sales tax is a different kind of a refund mechanism. Then it's not the same thing as a premium reduction from the state. But anyway, I'm happy to have Assistant Commissioner Terry Steenblock come up and talk more about their findings and our concerns about this.
Well, we did the sales tax rebate to everybody in the state in 99 and in 2001, and that never became an issue for us in the state. So clearly, like I said, there have been examples of that here on the state level. But members, we do have a couple of more amendments to do. If there's any other questions for Commissioner Franz while he is here, and Representative Hoppe, any comments at all?
Madam Chair, I'll wait for the amendments.
Okay, is there anybody else that wishes to testify to this bill? House File 107. All right, seeing none, with that, folks, in your packet, you do have another amendment, or should have it, the A1 amendment. Is it coming? Is it in the package? Okay. All right. Earlier, Commissioner France had expressed some concern about the rebate portion of this. This is to address some of his concerns. So if staff, Mr. Gehring, did you want to walk through this for members? If not, I...
Madam Chair, I actually might defer to Ms. Clarquist, who's in the audience. She drafted the language for this amendment.
That'd be great. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Elizabeth Clarkvist with House Research. The A1 amendment modifies the income eligibility requirements for the premium assistance program and the assistance amount. Instead of having the tiered structure with income eligibility and premium assistance amounts, it sets a flat assistance amount of 25% of the qualified premium, and it makes people between 300% and 800% of federal poverty guidelines eligible for assistance. So there's kind of one set of people who are eligible, and they get one assistance amount.
Great. I'm going to move the A1 amendment. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was wondering if I could ask, or if you could ask Assistant Commissioner Steenblok to comment, if she'd be willing to comment on the amendment to see if, what changes, if any, she thinks it may have.
Ms. Steenblok? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Terry Steenblok, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes at the Department of Revenue. And similar to what Commissioner France had said before, the IRS ultimately determines the federal taxability of income, so we would need some time to take a look at this amendment and consult with the IRS to determine the taxability here. But typically, payments that are made to individuals would be taxable income under federal law. But again, we would need some time to take this amendment and work with the IRS to determine the taxability.
Representative Johnson. Okay. And Ms. Steenblok, though, going back to 1991 and 2001, those were to individuals as well, correct?
As Commissioner France said, Madam Chair, members, as Commissioner France had said, that was administered through the sales tax, not the individual income tax. So there were several different variables there that are different than what is taking place here.
But it was sent to individuals, correct?
It was administered as a sales tax that was sent to individuals. But again, it was a sales tax.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Just briefly, Commissioner Steenblok.
He's trying to escape.
just briefly, does this make it easier to implement the House file with this amendment? I guess is one of the important issues that we're trying to get understand.
Madam Chair, members, in reference to the House file, as Commissioner France stated, there are many items that need to be reviewed or implemented. And along with this amendment, there would still be numerous things that would require systematic changes, would require identifying where to get the information, how to use the information, who can have access to the information, and then coordinating that based on the timing.
Representative Hoppe.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, to that point, I don't think it makes it harder. And this wasn't my idea, but the amendment was brought up earlier today and was in another committee. It was not offered by Representative Murphy, but I think it makes some sense. And I think it's at least I view it as a step towards the governor and Commissioner France's side of things. So, as I keep saying, we're willing to work on this. So,
any other questions, members? Well, seeing none, all those in favor of the the one amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The one amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else wishing to speak to this bill, House File 107? Seeing none, Representative Johnson, you have an amendment as well, or?
I do have an amendment, Madam Chair.
Just if I could, I apologize. I do not have my names on these amendments. I'll make sure that I have them in the future, so my apologies.
Representative Johnson. I just have the DE1 amendment.
Okay.
When you're ready.
Okay. Go ahead. Why don't you present your amendment, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the DE1 amendment presents an alternative, obviously, to the House File 107. The bill that Representative Hoppe has at this point, anyway, provides no relief in 2017 and a lot of red tape. And those are the two big problems that I have with it, that there's no relief now in an urgent time when people need it. And there's a lot of more red tape that's provided. I understand Representative Hoppe is willing to continue working on this, and for that I am grateful. But I know we have heard from, I have, and I guess probably everybody has, from a lot of people over the election period about the facing extreme hardship and with the bills they have to pay and all the Minnesotans that need premium relief right now at this point. One of the biggest problems I have is the databases that are laid out before us, the application process data system and the income verification, the verification of residence data, sharing private data with the health plans and so forth, and then these components communicating with each other. Madam Chair, I've shared with you my concern about cybersecurity and how I really think the state of Minnesota needs to invest in that, and I think the plan that's presented here is so much more complex than it needs to be, as we've heard, and it just creates another opportunity for cyber vulnerabilities, if nothing else. Not to mention the fact that we need to get the money out to people right away. So what this amendment does, Madam Chair, it combines an expedited, straightforward reimbursement system that basically is the governor's proposal with the transitional care coverage. So I'm being very collaborative here and taking that from Representative Hoppe's bill from House File 107. There's no need for a complex data collection system. There's no need to hire a whole set of new employees to implement a program. We can move forward with the DE1 amendment, pass it, and move forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hoppe, you want to care to comment?
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, I appreciate the amendment, and for right now, I would encourage members to vote no. I'd like to get the bill out of the committee and keep working on it, but I do like the idea that, as I say, work in progress, this is not the last stop, and we're going to have an opportunity. I think all of us will have opportunities to keep offering input. So with that, respectfully, Representative Johnson, I would encourage members to vote no.
And a roll call, please, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson has requested a roll call vote. Representative Johnson, I have a couple of questions for you on this plan that you have. So the governor's plan under here, part of what Commissioner France detailed is that the providers would be supplying the state with a list of those that are insured. The providers would have to be checking on the residency requirement. On all of this exchange of data from the providers to the state, what kind of data security is outlined in the bill? Where can I find that as part of the governor's plan?
Well, maybe Commissioner Steenbach, I don't know if she's available to address that, or some of the staff, they might be in a better position to address some of your security concerns, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Yes, Madam Chair, members. My name is Ryan Church. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Revenue. Pardon the frog in the throat this
That's
morning.
That's okay. Welcome.
This afternoon.
And you heard my question, right?
I'm sorry. Could you please repeat the question?
Just where can I find in the bill where we're taking care of the data security with all the transmission of data between the providers and the state?
As I understand it, under this bill, the information that would be transferred from the plan to the state would simply be invoice information, so that the plans could be reimbursed for the amount that they would discount the premiums for individuals.
And Deputy Commissioner Church, where would I see that in the bill as far as the data security piece, and how would that be transmitted, and what kind of system would the state establish to collect that data through maybe Minute, or, you know, what's kind of IT would we have to establish to get that up and running and to collect that and review it, and who would review it? Do we have FTEs that would be responsible, or is this going to be a hand application? Would that hand application take 2 hours to process, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, it's addressed in Section 2, payment to health carers on behalf of eligible individuals. And so that section of the bill, as I understand it, lays out the provisions for the information that the plans would provide to the state, and it would be on that basis that the state would provide reimbursement to those plans to offset the premium cost to individuals.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Church. But as Commissioner Franz highlighted, he said that they would be providing the state with a list of all the insureds for each of the individual plans. Where do we, in that transmission of data, this doesn't cover how that would be transmitted, how that would be encrypted or protected with all of that information, and even just with the invoice piece, you know, what would be part of that? And then also, how would that, I assume that there would be a cost to the providers to provide this, so where would that cost land? Is that going to be provided for by the state, or how does that get covered too?
So, Madam Chair, I don't think that section addresses the security of the transmission of that information. If that's something that the committee would want to see as a part of the bill, then you could address that.
Okay.
And in terms of the cost of the plans, I believe that the plans have been consulted about this, and it's not, to my knowledge, there is no, they are not saying that there would be an additional cost to them to do this, that they would be requested of the state. And as I look at the bill again, Madam Chair, I don't see any provision for payments to the plans to offset those costs. It's strictly for the purpose of reducing the cost of the premium to the individual.
Okay. Well, I'll maybe say that for Commerce then, too. I've got Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Representative Johnson, I guess. So what is the time to implement the governor's plan? You know, we've talked about, Chair Hoppe says 8 to 12 weeks, somewhere in there. Can you help us understand what your proposal is, or the governor's proposal?
Yes, Representative Nash, 8 to 12 weeks is the time frame that's been presented.
Okay, so 8 to 12 weeks.
Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. So 8 to 12 weeks for the governor's plan, 8 to 12 weeks for Representative Hoppe's plan. Ours has reform. And, you know, speaking, having spoken to hundreds of people over the last number of months, if we do nothing, if we don't implement some sort of reform, we're doing them a huge disservice. And you say that the governor is interested in providing reform, and I'm a little curious as to why there's no reform in the bill. Here we have a bill that provides relief to the individuals and brings reform and can be implemented in 8 to 12 weeks, the same as the proposal that you're bringing forward in your DE amendment. So I'm just confused.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, actually, testimony was that it would take a year for the 107 from the commissioner to be implemented to be 2018 when the applicants would actually get checked. So it's quite a difference from 8 to 12 weeks to 2018. And with respect to the policy information isn't in the bill we have before us, Representative Nash. That's not part of what we're dealing with today.
Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, under this bill, is there any provision in the bill someplace where the state has control over how fast the plans can give the rebates? In other words, what's to say that the plans take 60 or 90 days to issue the credits? Do we have any guarantees that it's going to be done in a timely manner in this bill?
Representative Johnson.
Maybe Commissioner could address that better than I, Madam Chair.
I think they're trying to decide which commissioner is going to come up.
You drew the short straw, sorry. Welcome back, Deputy Commissioner Church.
I'm not Assistant Commissioner.
Or Assistant, sorry.
No, I'm not.
Apologize.
I'm sorry, I need to hear the question again.
I didn't catch it.
Representative Uglum.
Yes, the question was, under this bill, do we have any guarantees on when the plans would provide the credit or the rebate back? Do we have any guarantees that this would be done in a timely manner? Or we all know what the cost of money is, and if we give the plans $300 million and they wait 60 or 90 days, they can make a lot of money on that money. So do we have any guarantees that this will be done in 30 days or no more than 60?
Madam Chair and Representative, again, I believe under the bill that the information reported from the plans would be done on a monthly basis, so there'd be invoicing done on a monthly basis. So it would be every 30 months that those payments would happen. And they would be based on reimbursements. So it would be four premiums paid each month. That would be the amount that would be offset each month. So month by month, the premium amounts paid by individuals would be reduced by these relief payments.
Madam Chair.
Representative Uglum.
Assistant Commissioner. Well, we're assuming that, aren't we? Do we spell that out in the bill anyplace? I couldn't find it.
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, again, in Section 2 is where it lays that out.
Representative Uglum. I was hoping, I think Catherine Commit from the council's here. I wanted to talk to you. Earlier we had the question of the cost piece of it. And assuming that the providers would pay for the cost piece of administering it, can you give me a ballpark figure of how much that would be on the cost side of things to administer it through the plans under this proposal? And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit. I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the trade group that represents seven nonprofit health plans here in Minnesota. And so to the question about would there be a cost, and the answer is yes. It's a little bit difficult to estimate what that cost is, but based on a quick survey of my health plans that would be involved in this, I'm giving an approximation of over $1 million to do that. And keep in mind, and that would be across all the plans, keep in mind that it's going to take us 8 to 12 weeks after this legislation is enacted to get it up and running so that we're able to change our systems, our IT systems, to be able to accomplish. That's just what's in the governor's proposal. The legislation in House File 107 has a different approach that would not be, that would send the money directly to the individuals, so that wouldn't really involve the health plans having to make major changes.
And who would pay for those costs?
Those costs are going to be administrative costs that the health plans will have to incur. But I mean, ultimately, those are always get passed through in the form of premiums.
So every premium holder then would pay for those administrative costs?
Madam Chair, as a portion of their overall, of the overall administrative costs, yes.
Okay. All right. We've got Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I had to step out on another matter when Commissioner Franz was testifying, and so I was hoping to ask, maybe he's returned, I'm not sure, but I was hoping to learn a little bit more about on the bill, line 20, or 2.20, where it talks about the funding for this DE amendment coming from the Health Care Access Fund. And the question I was hoping to ask the commissioner was, does he believe that the fund is solvent enough to be able to do this? If the fund runs short, which other group of Minnesotans who have access to insurance through this would be compromised with being able to receive insurance because the funding was being taken from here? I guess what I would do is I'd ask the DE author, Representative Johnson, maybe he has some information for me as to the solvency of the Health Care Access Fund, and should it not hit the bogey that we would be looking at, which Minnesotans would be hurt by taking the money out of this to provide premium relief, kind of a contrast between the two.
Representative Johnson, can you share?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think I'll be able to enlighten you on that, Representative Driscoll, on that particular point. I don't know if there's someone here from that has knowledge on that more than I. I would. Only thing I would say, I guess, is that this particular amendment, this delete all amendment, is not unlike Representative Hoppe's bill, somewhat a work in progress. I would argue that it's a better work in progress than his, and it's going to get money to consumers more quickly than his without the complexities. But your question is fair, but I don't have an answer for it.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, you know, the Healthcare Access Fund is set up and has been designed to provide dedicated relief to other Minnesotans on here. I am very concerned about us dipping into the Healthcare Access Fund and providing premium relief for another group that this was not intended for. The reserves that Representative Hoppe's bill, the state's rainy day fund, is designed to be able to take care of typically one-time shortfalls, which is what this is and what the governor is looking for. And so, members, I would encourage a no vote on the DE amendment for a number of reasons, but primarily because I don't want to put another one of Minnesota health plans or sources into financial peril like we're seeing right now with the outcome of the Minnesota adoption of Minshew and other kinds of things. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Olson.
So, Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Hoppe. So I'm new to this, and since I started getting sworn in last week, I have been flooded with calls with people who want premium relief, and I really appreciate that we're all here talking about this, and I think this is important. And as I learned the ways of state government finance and the investment we're making, I just had a couple of questions around being thoughtful about how we're thinking about immediate relief and long-term reform, and how these conversations have started blending and having clarity around that. So my question is, Representative Hoppe, in terms of new investment, we see some of the figures here, but in your mind, will this take more of an investment into state government operations and finance in this year and than what you see in the governor's plan?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Olson, and welcome, by the way. You know, I think it, and I hate to keep saying this, and I'm not trying to evade the answer, but I think we don't know yet. I don't think that, you know, one way or the other, if we set up a mechanism of paying people back, somebody's going to pay. And ultimately, it's going to be taxpayers, whether they're paying as consumers or whether they're paying as people that paid the money in, depending on, you know, wherever we get the money from, whether it's the Healthcare Access Fund or the reserves. I don't have and anybody else can add in. I'm not trying to evade your question, but I don't have a great answer for it.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also wanted to get a little clarity around the question around the taxable part, the sales tax versus the income tax. Representative Hoppe, do you feel confident that with the amount of relief and the way you're proposing relief would not fall into the income tax part?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, that part I really don't have an answer for. You know, I don't know. There are going to be a lot of changes coming out of Washington dealing with the Affordable Care Act. I am not neither an attorney nor an accountant. I'm certainly not a tax attorney. I don't know how this is going to be worked out. This is one of those things that we have a lot of smart people here at the table, and we're going to have a lot of our staff that work on this. And, you know, I'm not trying to oversimplify, but we need to have a bill that we can pass, that the Senate can pass, and that ultimately the governor can sign. And those are things that will get taken care of between now and then. I don't have a perfect answer for you right now.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hoppe. That's very helpful. I just want to be able to answer my constituents about the type of things we're putting forward with confidence on those types of things that will greatly affect them. And so I appreciate that you are answering those questions and being thoughtful about how that's brought forward.
Yeah, no more questions for you. This is trouble.
Representative Ward.
Neither one of them were close. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I would really like to make more of a comment than have a question. And my concern is separating the immediate response from the work that we know needs to happen on the larger issues, the longer-term issues of health care reform. I'm originally from Kansas, and I grew up in Tornado Alley. And last Wednesday at the chamber dinner, Speaker Dowd talked about how if 5% of the roofs in this state blew off in a storm, we would be there to put the roofs back on in a minute. And we would. We would be coming to the aid of those people to be sure that there wasn't more damage done to their homes. We'd be sure that they had a roof over their homes. We would not at the same time say, we have to, before we can put the roof on your house, we have to decide, you have to decide and tell us how you're going to put the kitchen back together and remodel the bathroom, because you're going to have to do all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But the first thing is to get the roofs on and protect the rest of the house. The rest of it can come later. And it just strikes me that there's a real parallel here. We have an urgent need, and I've been hearing it. You were all hearing it at the doors starting last June, if not before. Emails, phone calls, and talking to people at the door. They want to know what's going to happen and how they can make a decision on such an important thing as their health care. So I would prefer that we would address the roof before we have to deal with landscaping or anything else.
Well, thank you, Representative Warden. Thank you for those comments. You know, the great thing is that we're all on the same page, that we see this as a problem that needs to be addressed. I appreciate Representative Johnson bringing forward an alternative proposal to try and address the issue, too. With that, you have requested a roll call, and I'm going to have the clerk take the roll.
Chair Anderson?
No.
Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Detmer?
No.
Representative Fenton?
No.
Representative Flanagan?
Yes.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Kunesh-Podein?
Yes.
Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Olmar?
Yes.
Representative Pugh?
No.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Ugham?
No.
Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative Ward?
Yes.
On a vote of 10 to 6, the amendment is not adopted. Final comments to your bill, Representative Hoppe.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much. I've got a couple of things that I wrote down. I will try to be brief. A good discussion, and as I keep saying, this is a work in progress. I think most of the comments that I made, other than one, I've already said, or we've already heard. We're going on to another committee stop, another couple of committee stops in the House. They're doing this in the Senate. Representative Johnson and Olson and others, I look forward to working with everybody and trying to come to a conclusion. And I didn't come up with this, unless you really like it, then I did. But a wise man once told me that one man's red tape is another man's program integrity. So with that, members, I would appreciate your support. Thank you for your time.
Great. And members, just we have one little correction. The actual roll call vote was 10 to 7, and the minutes will reflect that as well. We're new here, so just help us out a little bit. Members, any further questions? Is there anybody else that wishes to speak to this bill? Seeing none, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 107 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Okay, the amendment or the bill moves forward. Thank you, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, folks, we have just a few more housekeeping items that I thought we could take care of. In your packet, you should have some of these. I think for any of you that met with me, we would be able to provide you with this information. But I also asked for nonpartisan staff to do some walkthroughs. And I don't know, Ms. Roberts or Mr. Gehring, which one of you wants to go first? Oh, you got the thumb. Sorry, Ms. Roberts. You're going to go first.
Well, Madam Chair, I should ask you, there's two things, well, a couple things that are in the packet. One is the chart that shows the overview of accounts and then also the spreadsheets. Which would you prefer to start with?
I think an overview of the spreadsheets first.
Yeah. Overview of the spreadsheets. Yeah. Members, there are actually three spreadsheets in your packet, and I'm not going to walk through them in detail because, as you can see, we have a long list of accounts in state government finance. But what you have is one that is entitled the summary of the 215 and 216 omnibus bills. I'll be looking at that one. The other two provide you the actual what we call change items. So those are the specific spending decisions that were made in the previous two sessions for this committee. And again, looking at the summary, it's just the one page. You can see that the different columns show the different positions that were held in the two previous sessions. The base for new members is the starting point, and that's actually established in law. And then the spreadsheet also shows the governor's position, Senate, House, and the final enacted budget, including the decisions in both sessions. And I should just say real quickly, since I know we don't have a lot of time, that I'm available for any member that wants to need to walk through this individually because it's going to go pretty quickly. So just let me know. And I think I'll just reference the enacted numbers real quickly. But if members have any questions about the other columns or what's making up these numbers, just let me know. So starting at the beginning of the summary spreadsheet, you'll see that this committee funds the legislature itself. And the total funding for the legislature for the biennium is $158 million. This committee also funds all of the constitutional offices. So you'll see the governor's office funded at $7.2 million, the state auditor at $4.4 million, the attorney general at $44 million, and the secretary of state at $13.3 million. And this is a good place for me to point out again, I'm focusing on the general fund, because that's where our target is going to be established. There, for many of our agencies, they have significant non-general fund activity, and the state auditor would be one of those agencies that has non-general fund activity, and I can provide more detail on that, and we do track the non-general fund activity. Moving on to lines 22 and 23, the committee funds the campaign finance board, both the operations of the board at $2.3 million, and also the public subsidy program. That's the payments that go to the candidates. Also included is in this committee is the investment board that invests all of the state's retirement funds. They have a small general fund appropriation of $278,000 for the biennium. And then the administrative hearings office, again, this is an agency that has the largest portion of their funding is not from the general fund, but it's for the workers' compensation judges and special revenue fund. Minute services is also funded through this committee, and their general fund is $5.1 million for the biennium. Again, this is an agency whose largest part of their funding is not from a direct general fund appropriation, but from the services that they provide to agencies. And then they charge agencies for those services. The Department of Administration, you can see they have two programs that we fund, and I believe you're hearing from them tomorrow, so you'll hear in much more detail about the various activities they do. The Department of Administration also oversees the public broadcasting grants, and then also includes the appropriation for what's known as the in lieu of rent payment, which I believe will probably be hearing more about, but it is an appropriation that covers the expenses of this building and then the ceremonial spaces in the Capitol. So the total general fund for the Department of Administration for the biennium is approximately $48 million. The CAP board is also under the jurisdiction of this committee. They oversee the Capitol area. Their funding is $685,000 for the biennium. Minnesota Management Budget is, again, one of our agencies, and their funding is $48 million for the biennium. And then after that, you'll see a bunch of what are called MMB open appropriations. And again, I won't go into these for detail, but for new members, when we talk about an open appropriation, that's something that's actually in statute, but not in session law. And it's called open because the amount needed for that activity is appropriated. So it's not a specific dollar amount. But MMB has several of these related to their operations. The Department of Revenue is funded through this agency for a total for their general fund is $283 million, and I believe they're the largest of our agencies that are funded through this committee. I noted on this spreadsheet the political contribution refund two-year suspension. This was done in the supplemental bill last year. I probably should remove this from the spreadsheet because that's actually in the tax bill's jurisdiction, and that piece is the payments that go to individuals, the refunds to individuals. We also have the gambling agencies under this committee's jurisdiction. They are primarily funded through non-general fund sources, although we did provide a small appropriation to the Racing Commission because they're in transition and sort of redoing their fees, and so they needed a little bit of help in the last biennium. But so we have the Lawful Gambling Control Board that's funded off the general fund, and then the Racing Commission, and this commission or this committee also oversees the operations of the lottery. The Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, the biennial appropriation here, you're seeing a summary of $10.6 million. The actual operating budget for the commission is much smaller than that. I think it's below $1 million. The largest part of this funding was supplemental funding provided last session for the Mighty Ducks program. And then you can see the next four lines are the four ethnic councils. And I have to apologize. I was so focused on the numbers, I forgot to update the names of the councils because three of the councils have changed their names, and I will do that in a revised spreadsheet. But you can see the funding levels for those four councils. The next item in line 72 is the Minnesota Historical Society with an appropriation of $44 million for the biennium. And then there's also an open general fund for the Historic Preservation Grant Program. This committee has oversight of the general fund portion of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and their biennial appropriation is $15 million. The Humanities Commission on line 77 has a biennial appropriation of $1.4 million. And then the Human Rights Department has an appropriation of just over $8 million. And I would just note that that is the one agency that is in a different committee in the Senate. After that, on lines 79 through 82, you'll see the four occupational boards and their funding levels, 1.2 for the county board, 1.6 million for the Board of Architectural Engineering. It has a very long name that I couldn't fit on the spreadsheet, but it has many different items that are included in that. 5.1 million for the Board of Cosmetologists Examiners, and then 646 for the Board of Barber Examiners. On line 84 and 85, you'll see two smaller appropriations that are handled by the Department of Finance. The contingent account is one that sometimes comes up in this committee. It's available when there are some emergencies or unforeseen costs that state agencies, often small agencies, can't handle under their normal appropriation. Towards the end of the spreadsheet, you'll see the appropriation for the Minnesota State Retirement System. This appropriation says for the Consolidated Legislators and Constitutional Officers Retirement. I think it's important to note this is for the pre-1997 legislators and constitutional offices. So it's not, unless you were elected before 1997, it's not the current legislators' retirement, but it is a plan that was not funded. It was kind of funded on a pay-as-they-retire basis, and so there is that's why we have to do a direct general fund appropriation. It's something that members that are on the Pension Commission would be familiar with. And then I should also add into here, I missed it on the summary sheet, but you'll see it on the detail sheets, that there was a $3 million appropriation made in the supplemental budget for the judge's retirement plan, and we will be carrying that amount. There's $12 million to the PERA fund, and that's to cover the cost of the Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund merger. On the second page of the spreadsheet, $59 million to TRA. That's to cover the Minneapolis and Duluth teachers mergers into the plan. That's why they're receiving aid in this committee. And then aid to the St. Paul teachers plan of $19.6 million. And just a note, so the total for all of the pension aids that are in this committee is it's about $110 million over the biennium, so that's a significant chunk of the overall funding for this committee. And finally, the last two agencies that are funded through this committee are the Military Affairs, Department of Military Affairs, or the National Guard, and their total funding directly is $38.9 million. They also have an open general fund appropriation for when the National Guard is ordered to state duty, so that's for natural disasters, et cetera. And finally, the Veterans Affairs Department, which I should note has two really different programs. There's programs and services directly to veterans, and then the $110 million, the largest portion of their budget is for the veterans' homes. So just to really summarize really quickly, the total funding for this, all of the agencies direct and open general fund authorized in the last two sessions was approximately $1 billion. And again, I know that was really quick. So,
no. Members, any questions to the spreadsheet at all? Okay. All right, Mr. Gehring, you want to go through yours? Thank you, Mr.
Madam Chair, so what I'm going to do is go through the policy items that were included in the 2015 and 2016 state government finance bills, and there is a smaller handout that I know Mr. Moyer was working on getting copies of that should go around at this point. You do in your packet have copies of the House Research Act summaries from the 2015 and the 2016 bills, which I think you have all seen in meeting with Chair Anderson previously, but you can feel free to reference them if you want more detail on any of the items that I'm going to talk about. But for now, what you're going to see is what I call the consolidated summary of the policy that's organized by topic category. And it's just a three-page sheet that will go through the general items that were included in both 15 and 16. So I'm going to start.
Members, the document is coming.
Okay. So the first thing I'm going to highlight, Madam Chair, is the changes that were enacted in 2015 related to the Office of the State Auditor. This language permits counties to choose to have their required audits performed by either a private CPA firm or the state auditor herself. The language allows the auditor to retain some oversight over the audits, including some establishment of standards and requiring additional information from CPA firms if that's required. Madam Chair, as you know, and as probably most members of the committee know, this language is subject to some ongoing litigation. The litigation right now is in the appeals process, and I would expect that a Court of Appeals decision related to the language will be issued probably towards the end of session. But to this point, the state auditor's challenges to this language have not been successful. The second item on the table relates to provisions that affect information technology and minute services within the state. There are a variety of administrative provisions that were included within this section, both in 15 and 16. Some of them include the ability for MMB to prepay for certain IT hosting services. There are some changes to the way that Minute receives repayment of its cash flow funds that it receives. There's also a report that was submitted to the legislature last year from Minute related to the use of chief IT officers in state agencies. Next on the table, which you'll see, is the reorganization of the ethnic councils. Ms. Roberts already mentioned this when she was referencing her spreadsheet. So the new ethnic councils in Minnesota are the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs, the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, and the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. As part of the reorganization in 2015, there were new executive directors hired for the councils. One of the things that you can expect to see shortly will be annual reports from each of the councils on their progress and some measurable outcomes on advocating for their particular constituencies. Those reports are due on the 15th of this month. Next is a series of sections that relate to state contracting and purchasing. There's a variety of provisions within this section. Most of them focus on targeted group contracting and purchasing. So there are provisions that attempt to facilitate more frequent use of women and minority-owned businesses, as well as businesses that are small businesses that are owned by veterans. Language related to the veteran-owned small businesses was included in the House versions of the bills in 2015 and 2016. Next is a series of provisions that relate to the state budgeting process. Many of these items were also included in the House proposal from 2015 and in 2016. Among the items that are included here are changing the deadline for MMB to recommend a percentage of the state budget to go towards the budget reserve. That's shifted from January until September. There's some terminology and some other administrative procedure changes related to the way the Legislative Advisory Committee reviews requests to spend federal money that's been awarded to the state. MMB is required to also newly report levels of uncertainty when they're conducting, when they issue their state revenue forecast. So there'll be a revenue forecast, and then within 14 days, the commissioner is required to also report on how much uncertainty is included within that forecast. And then another thing I'll highlight that you'll see soon is a report from the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy, which is a report that relates to the establishment of joint legislative budget targets, and that report is due on the 15th of this month. Ms. Roberts already mentioned the suspension of the political contribution refund program, so that suspension remains in effect until July 1st of 2017, and absent any further action by the legislature, that program would blink back on as of July 1st. There's been administrative changes related to public benefit corporations in the 2015 House bill. These just relate to these are corporations that have some sort of mission to serve a public good in addition to their general corporate fiduciary duties. So there are some technical changes related to the way those corporations register and interact with the office of the Secretary of State. There's also some sort of miscellaneous and administrative changes related to the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund. This was included in the bill in 2016. And then, Madam Chair, next is a section that relates to eminent domain. This is, Madam Chair, I know, Bill, you're quite familiar with. That relates to the ability of railroads to use eminent domain powers on county-owned land within Hennepin County. That was enacted. There's a series of sections in the 2015 and also in the 2016 bills that relate to the occupational licensing boards. There's administrative changes related to the operation of the Board of Cosmetology Examiners in the field of cosmetology law. Also, there's a series of administrative changes related to the Board of Barber Examiners, and then administrative changes related to the Board of Accountancy, and all of those are included in both the 15 and 16 versions of the bill. Next is a required review by the Office of Legislative Auditor on general and exclusive incentive programs in the state. These incentive programs are programs that are designed by state law to encourage businesses to either relocate to Minnesota or to stay in Minnesota if they're considering leaving. Currently underway is a review by the OLA on the Research and Development Tax Credit for businesses conducting technological research activities in Minnesota, and the OLA, as far as I understand, is expected to issue its report on that program later this year. There's a specific article in the 2015 bill that relates to lawful gambling issues. Ms. Roberts already mentioned that portions of those issues are within the jurisdiction of this committee. There is a section from the 2016 bill that relates to the Angel Investment Tax Credit that was included. And then the next row that I have on the table is what I called sort of miscellaneous government operations issues. There's a whole number of things that I included within that category that are all a little bit too specific to get their own category, but this ranges from sort of complex or more slightly more complex state programs like the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program and the Healthy Eating Here at Home Program, both of which were adopted by this committee, and then it also includes relatively more narrow items like regulating how long-distance cell phone use is recorded for, regulating how long-distance telephone use is recorded by state employees and elected officials, and some other relatively more narrow items like that. Then the last item on the table that I have for you is a series of items that relate to military and veterans affairs. All things that are listed there were included in the House proposals either in 2015 or 2016. And these include some expedited and temporary licensing allowances for specific professions, including optometry, dietitians and nutritionists, family and marriage therapists, professional counselors, alcohol and drug counselors, licensed podiatrists, barbers, and cosmetology. So all that list that I just read, there are new provisions in law that allow members of the military to get expedited temporary licenses if they want to act in those professions. There's also some administrative changes related to the Veterans Preference Act, an income tax subtraction for military retirement pay, then a series of studies, one of which relates to mental and behavioral health for veterans, and then also a study related to the feasibility of partnerships to provide interim housing for disabled veterans. Then the last thing in the military and veterans affairs category that I would note would be there will be a new memorial on the Capitol grounds that commemorates recipients of the Medal of Honor. And I'm sure that's the quick overview of the policy items. One other item that I would just mention to the committee that I think the committee members might be of interest, have interest in is the, as you know, the new legislative salary council constitution amendment was ratified by the voters in 2016. This was not part of the budget bills in my view. This was something that was proposed in 2013, but does affect the legislature, so it will be within the jurisdiction of this committee. I bring that up only because that council has begun to meet. I just want to remind members that members of the legislature are prohibited by law from communicating with members of the council while they're meeting. We will expect a report from them either on or before March 31st. And so I would just keep in mind that if you have questions, you can either direct them to me or Ms. Roberts or your caucus staff, but don't contact the council itself.
Everybody got that piece, I hope. Okay. All right. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gehring, on your first topic, it's not included in the summary, but you had touched on the point that the auditor was given some oversight and encumbrances on the counties that were gaining the option of selecting who would do the audit. What about the third or so of counties that previously had that capability and freedom? Are those encumbrances and oversight extended to them, so there's a change in that relationship?
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Quan, the way I understand the change in law is that now all counties are allowed to choose to use a private CPA firm or use the state auditor if they would like to. And as you know, there are some counties that already did that with the agreement of the state auditor, and the change in the law expanded that to make that an option for every county in the state.
Representative Quan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was more concerned about understanding the added oversight that the auditor was given to sort of compensate for the change, if that also was umbrella across the ones that third or so that previously had the freedom, or if it just was impacting the newly free counties.
Well, Representative Quam, the state auditor has the authority to review any county at any time, even those that they have exempted from direct audits through her office. And so she always has that flexibility to do that. If you're interested in how that office is operating now, you'll have an opportunity to ask that question when the state auditor comes in to present her office's budget. So we can dig into it at that point if you wish. Members, any other questions at all? All right. With that, we have 5 minutes. Representative Johnson, just state your name. We're doing introductions quick because we do have new members here.
Oh.
And state your name and where you're from, and we'll just quick go around the room, and then right. We're done with that.
Very good. Sheldon Johnson, I represent South St. Paul.
Leon Lilly, representing North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale, part of Maplewood, and Oakdale. Representative Ward has the rest or parts of it.
Representative Ilhan Umar, representing Minneapolis, District 60B.
Mary Kunish-Podine, representing St. Anthony Village, southern half of New Brighton, Columbia Heights, and Hilltop.
Mm-hmm. Cindy Pugh, House District 33B, representing Chanhassen and 9 of the 16 communities surrounding Lake Minnetonka.
Mark Uglum, representing 36A, which is all of Champlin and part of Coon Rapids.
Bob Vogel, representing 20A, which is southern Scott and western Lee Sore County.
Jim Nash, District 47A, most of Carver County, except for what Representative Hoppe has.
John Hultquist, Committee Administrator.
I'm Sarah Anderson. I'm from Plymouth.
And Sam Moyer, again, Committee Legislative Assistant.
Brian Cook, the Republican Caucus Researcher.
Helen Roberts, Fiscal Analyst.
Matt Gehring from Nonpartisan House Research.
Liz Olson, representing District 7B, the western half of Duluth.
Dwayne Crom, parts of Dodge and Olmsted County.
Steve Green, District 2B in northwest Minnesota, represent all or parts of Norman, Becker, Clearwater, Howard, and Wadena counties.
And Bob Detmer from Forest Lake, 39A, which is much of Washington County and parts of Chisago County.
I'm Peggy Flanagan. I represent 46A. It's Golden Valley, St. Louis Park, Plymouth, and Medicine Lake.
I'm Representative Kelly Fenton. I have House District 53B, which is just Woodbury.
Representative Samuel Driscoll from the South House Lockup, Central Minnesota area, and I hope you get to know who that guy is over there, too.
Representative Joanne Ward, 53A, so I have part of Woodbury, part of Maplewood, part of Oakdale, and all of Landfall.
Jim Geldman, DFL Caucus Research.
Thanks, guys. With that, we are...